Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. Today, we welcome Danny Ludeman to the show. Danny is the former president and CEO of Wells Fargo Advisors and is the founder and CEO of Concordance Academy of Leadership, a nonprofit that provides reentry services to incarcerated individuals. So, Danny, I'm so excited to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for agreeing to be with me today. And I'm so excited for our listening audience to get to hear your story. So let's just jump right in because there's a lot of things I want to talk about. So talk to us a little bit about your upbringing. Where did you grow up? Just talk to us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me, Lisa. It's a pleasure. I was very fortunate. I grew up in a very loving family. My parents became Christians when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I grew up in southern Florida for the first 9 years of my life, 6 years in Miami and 3 years in Fort Lauderdale. And then we moved to Richmond, Virginia when I was 9. And I accepted the Lord as my Savior around 12 years old. I feel very, very fortunate, very, very blessed. We didn't come from a whole lot, but that was also what was kind of cool to see with my father, because he was a stockbroker in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. That's what brought us to Richmond. He worked for a bank called State Planners Bank back then, and then rose to become president CEO of that bank.
Is
so
that
it was just
right?
Wonderful to see the transformation, what God was doing with him. You know, I'm very, very grateful, and I would say that who I am today is clearly a combination of the values that my parents instilled in me at a very young age.
Mm-hmm. Well, so talk to us a little bit about you can talk about your educational journey and...
It's interesting to look back on it because I think in many respects I can see this journey, which ultimately led me here to start and run Concordance. But I went to
you
Virginia.
You didn't see that, though,
didn't
back
see it at the
then,
no,
right?
Didn't see it at all.
Yeah.
So I had, I went to Virginia Tech undergrad, economics major, and then I started off at a very small brokerage firm called We First Securities. I was the 299th financial advisor in D.C. right after school. And then I came back to the home office and was given some management responsibilities. And they grew and grew, eventually ended up heading up the firm.
Mm-hmm.
But what bothered me was that we could compete with a lot of the larger wirehouses on culture, on the family feel, but we couldn't compete when it came to providing the whole array of services for our clients.
Mm.
And so the brokerage business is a very scale-oriented business. And so one of the first things I did was we interviewed 7 larger firms, 6 banks and 1 insurance company, and we picked First Union because they wanted to invest in our business. So we sold the First Union, And then we went on a, there were two things we did. We went on a quest to get scale and scope. We bought 15 firms in a 10-year period, became the second largest brokerage firm in the country. The last one was A.G. Edwards, mm-hmm. not the biggest one, but the last right. one. Mm-hmm. As much as I tried to keep the headquarters in Richmond, Virginia, the deal wasn't going to happen unless
you moved here, right.
So I was calling on A.G. Edwards ever since I got my job. So I'd come to St. Louis one day. First 3 years were Ben Edwards, and then the next 7 years were Bob Bagby. Meetings were usually very short. They were fiercely independent, didn't want to consider merging with us.
Sure.
And then something happened when I called in April of 1997, and that's when I found out later they're being pursued by this other entity. So we could match social issues, price, pretty much everything.
It could be more of a friendly.
Exactly.
Friendly situation,
exactly.
right?
But the other firm wasn't willing to keep headquarters in St. Louis, and so that was a give. And so we made a decision to move the corporate headquarters. We actually moved 1,400 families to St. Louis, which was the largest corporate reload ever done in America in terms of number of people moving.
Mm-hmm.
But it also violated every rule of merger 101 because you don't want to disrupt both sides.
Yes.
And so where I fell in love with St. Louis was the city really did rally to help us. And so a lot of people that were in Richmond, just like people in St. Louis, they never moved in their life. They're born and raised in the area. Mm-hmm. They've gone to school in the area. And so because we needed people to move, Civic Progress, Regional Business Council, the Chamber, WashU, probably 10 organizations came together and helped us put what was referred to as Meet Me in St. Louis weekends. So we brought probably 1,800 families in over an 83-week period. And out of those 1,800 families that came, 1,400.
That's incredible.
Moved. So it was, you know, when you feel a little vulnerable, you know, I really... I mean, that's why I ended up staying in St. Louis. I love mm-hmm. St. Louis and mm-hmm. just the heart that the city had. They helped me and helped our firm greatly by mm-hmm. recruiting all these people here.
Right. So then you were the CEO for Wells Fargo Advisors for several years. You can talk a little bit about that. And then I want to really talk about your retirement and your halftime.
Well, when we came to St. Louis in 07 as Wachovia Securities, and then Wachovia, like a number of firms during the Great Recession, fell on hard times. And then Wells Fargo came in and bought Wachovia. You know, I've been on both sides mm-hmm. of mergers. I've been bought
the bought and
twice,
the buying.
And I've bought a lot of firms.
Right.
And Wells Fargo was a wonderful partner. They didn't have a very large brokerage operation, and so one of the first things they announced, like the day after the deal, was that, you know, they're committed to what became Wells Fargo Advisors, committed to St. Louis, committed to the campus, and so that took a lot of concern and worry out of the way. So,
yes.
I mean, Wells Fargo, they handled the merger very, very well. They listened. They really did not understand the brokerage business very well. But what I was thrilled with is that the then current CEO, John Stump, and now the CEO, Tim Sloan, they spent a lot of time. We had weekly meetings where we would pick a topic and we'd present a deck that we'd give to them a couple days in advance. They would always be very well-versed. They read each page.
Mm-hmm.
But we did that for a year and a half. And so they got to understand
the
business.
Right.
They felt
mm-hmm.
comfortable with the business, and mm-hmm. they invested a lot of money in us. So it really worked out extremely well.
And realized that they didn't know a lot about it. So you guys were the subject matter experts. I think that's an important part of a leader, too.
I mean, I was just thrilled that they kept an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of times mm-hmm. I'm guilty, a lot of people are guilty of forming an opinion based upon, could be old information, could be partial information. And sometimes when that happens, we tend to look, it's called confirmation bias, and we tend to look at people, institutions, businesses through a lens that confirms our initial impression. And so somebody may do 99 out of 100 things exactly right,
mm-hmm.
but if they do one thing that's a little different, that's what people tend to hang on to.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really them. I was just pleased that they were open-minded and wanted to truly learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a big lesson in leadership in that a lot of leaders, if they don't understand a business, and I saw a lot of this happening with shifts around where a leader would be put in charge of a business, and they would basically delegate the responsibility for that business to some leader, mm-hmm. which is a good thing, but they never really took the time to learn the business and therefore added very little value. So until individuals believe that you truly have your best interests at heart, people can misinterpret that as just messing around with you. Maybe you think there's another motive. Maybe they're trying mm-hmm. to catch you. I had a boss like that at Wachovia where he didn't understand the business and I misunderstood what was needed there. And so he had the thirst for information. He would go talk to people all over, you know, our company, 10 levels down. At first, you know, I felt like he was intruding on the business. And so I kept a little bit of a curtain around mm-hmm. our business, somewhat fearful that he was really just looking to catch something.
Doing something wrong.
And right. exactly, catch just doing something. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the phrase. And but then I learned that he just didn't know the business, had a thirst for the business. And once I spent time with him, it changed on a dime. And I realized that he really did have my best interests at heart. Mm-hmm. And the more information I provided him, the more details I provided him, the less need he had to go trying to find certain things for
right.
it just changed the whole relationship.
Right. Well, so how long were you the CEO for Wells Fargo Advisors? And 15 years.
Well, I mean, counting, so I've only been one firm my whole
right.
life, 35
right.
years, lots of different names, but one firm. And so I took over in 1998 and then retired at 2004. So 15 years as CEO, which is, I would say, is too long. I got a lot of advice from people locally here, actually, early on in my career. They were friends of my mentor, Jim Wheat, that you want to be careful that you don't define your life by your career. So many people do that, but we're only stewards of the business, and therefore we have to catch ourselves because it's easy to get into an ownership mentality. It's easy sometimes to let your ego get a little bit ahead of you. And so one good friend recommended that he thought that CEOs ought to declare, not necessarily publicly, but a time frame for when they should step down. And so 10 years was my goal, but that's right when we bought A.G. Edwards, and a couple years later, Wells Fargo yeah. bought Wachovia, so also learned you can't necessarily extract yourself from an organization on your time
frame. Right. It's a timing thing.
But I think his advice was one of the main reasons that I retired.
Okay.
I lost a little bit of my mojo, but a lot of it was I'd done it too long, and it's important to give other people the opportunity.
The opportunity.
So I spent a lot of time developing, because we bought a lot of firms, and I'm surprised they didn't have necessarily great leaders underneath the CEO. There wasn't a lot of development, so.
So you spent a lot of time probably doing that, didn't you?
A lot of that,
and
so yeah. I felt wonderful. I mean, I can't imagine working at a company your whole life and then leaving and then not feeling like it's in good
You're
hands.
You're leaving
so
them in good
we
hands.
Had, I mean, there well, were a number of people that could have headed it up when I left.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Danny, and I'm excited for him to tell you what he's doing today. Hi, everybody. I just wanted to take a second and tell you about something our team at Technology Partners can do for your business. We have spent over 2 decades partnering with organizations and helping them solve their IT needs from a 360-degree perspective. A huge part of how we solve those needs is by developing custom applications of all shapes and sizes. If your team is looking for software and an out-of-the-box solution just isn't right, it's time to consider how we might be able to help. Go to tpi.co/custom apps and learn more about our awesome capabilities. All right, we're back with Danny Ludeman, and I want Danny to talk a little bit about his journey after he retired from Wells Fargo Advisors, and then he'll get into a little bit about what he's doing today, which is really exciting.
So when I retired, the only thing that I was certain of is I wanted to go to seminary. Not to become a minister per se, but just to learn more. And on my application, when they asked me questions about it, and I applied 6 months to a year before I retired because I wasn't sure if they would accept me. It's been a while since I applied to a graduate school. But I put on there that my purpose was to learn more about how to love God with all my heart, strength, soul, and mind, and how to love my neighbors, myself. So that was the purpose. So I did get accepted, and I enrolled, started classes January 2014. And so that was happening, and then I received this beautiful letter as a result of the article from a woman named Candace O'Connor, who was chairperson of this very small nonprofit in town called Project Cope. And Project Cope had been doing wonderful things for about 30 years, very small, where they had like one caseworker, they had 11 apartments, and they were serving people that were coming out of one of the 21 state penitentiaries in the state of Missouri. And the coolest thing they did was they formed these partnership teams with houses of worship where people from those houses of worship would spend, there would be about five or six on a team, and then they would walk side by side, their partner, as they called them, for a year. So they were looking for an executive director, and so I met with her only because the letter was extremely beautiful. Mm. Later found out she was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, so that probably has something to do with the letter. After listening to her, what they did, I went back and talked to Susan, and I said, I'm just not sure about this. I want to help people, but this might just be too much in the bowels of society for me. I didn't really know anybody had gone to prison, but it scared me. You know, I feel somewhat embarrassed now to admit that, but I think it's like a lot of things that are new that we don't understand, mm-hmm. that we have certain perceptions about. Again, that's where fear comes in. But because she was persistent, I met with her again, and it was in the second meeting that is the sole reason I started Concordance and I'm here now, and that was she relayed a statistic. She said that 77% of people that come out of prison commit another crime within a 3 to 5 year period, and it's been that way for 30 years, no improvement. And so it was a head thing for me. You know, a lot of things I don't do well, but one of my God-given talents is strategic planning. And so I went back and talked to her and said, listen, I can't be executive director now. I just need more time to discern, but I will help you do a strategic plan. And it wasn't just a plan for Project Cope. It was really more of a plan for how do you solve this holistic problem. Mm-hmm. And so from there, I called the governor, who I got to know. This was when Governor Nixon, because of all the jobs, we moved to St. Louis. So he was my second person on the committee. And he said, you know, Danny, I'm probably not going to be able to make a lot of your meetings. So he put his chief of staff on. Then the fourth person was the head of corrections for the state of Missouri, George Lombardi. And then it grew from there. County Executive Charlie Dooley, County Executive Steve Ellman were part of this, all the police chiefs. It grew to about 70 people. And like any strategic plan you'd be familiar with, we took five work streams, allocated them out. Somebody looked at the 8 criminogenic factors. Somebody looked at just the effects of cognitive thinking on just being incarcerated alone. So if you and I went to prison, somewhere around the 9th to 12th month, our thinking would change as a survival mechanism, and you need to undo that when you come out. We looked at the 4,500 laws in Missouri that are on the books that affect some type of reentry activity. And so the question that the group was trying to answer, and there really was one question with one subpart to it, and that was with proper leadership, proper resources, and using only evidence-driven practices, could you materially lower reincarceration rates, first mm-hmm. in St. Louis, then Missouri, then the rest of the country? And it was unanimous at the end of 9 months. So from that point, we hired WashU to develop our whole reentry model. And after we developed the program, while we're doing that, it took WashU about a year and a half to do it. Then I met with a number of people in the community. I wanted to see if they would support this effort. And then I went out and started raising money.
Mm-hmm. You raised a lot of money in a very short period of time, Danny, didn't you?
But I was very fortunate. The business community rallied behind this. And so it was, and that's what I like about St. Louis, because when there is a big problem and a spotlight is focused on that problem, St. Louisans rally like nobody I've ever seen before. So it's been wonderful. We've been providing services. We took our first class May of 2016, so we've been doing this for 2.5 years. Our goal has been to serve 250 participants each year, 42 in each class, so we have a statistically significant population. We just finished interviewing class 13. Our program is 18 months. We have clinicians and educators in 3 prisons that tend to release mostly to St. Louis. So we're in the 2 men's prison, Pacific and Bonterre, and then we serve the women's prison in Vandalia. The results have just been incredible. Wash U put a goal on there of cutting reincarceration rates by a third by offering these 12 holistic, integrated, only using evidence-driven practices that have proven to work for this population. And to date, we've lowered it by about 55%. We're still early, but we're excited about that.
That's so exciting. And so for you, you've got some new initiatives, and I want to talk a little bit about that. There's many things that someone needs when they're coming out of that situation, and one is employment, and so you're skilling up people. But I also want to talk to you about your plans for expansion.
What I'd like to just go back on, because I don't think I stated this, so there are an awful lot of myths about this population, including ones that I had. You know, what has been probably the biggest learning for me has been that the overriding issue here that our world will face over the next several generations is the impact of trauma on individuals. So every single one of our participants, we do a lot of assessments in the first 4 weeks in our pre-release program, every single one of them has had a horrific traumatic event defined as either being shot, stabbed, raped, physically beaten, or seen a loved one die in front of them by the age of 9. All of them.
Not one exception.
Mm-hmm. And so that leads to mental health issues. 83% of our participants have substance use disorder. It leads to physical health issues, lack of education, no job skills, no consistent work, homelessness, no health care, no family or community support. And each of these individuals that were all created in God's image like you and I have this perpetual stigma of being a felon for life. And so the reason there has been absolutely no improvement in this country in 30 years is because you're dealing with so many complex issues. And the second reason is this is not a cause that people wish to support financially. It's like my first reaction. These individuals can appear to be scary or whatever when they're not really. But what happens is, whether you're in St. Louis or across the country, limited funding, you know, as a business person, you realize that you can only focus on one or two things, and you want to do it well. Mm-hmm. But the research has shown time and time again that one or two solutions has been a failed proposition in truly helping this population. It is not hard to find a participant a job. It's extremely hard for that participant to keep a job, because if you can't stay sober, you got other serious mental health issues, maybe you're not taking certain medication. And so that's like one of those myths. So, and don't get me wrong, it's always wrong to commit a crime. We're not, and that's another myth. None of our participants say they never did it. But they made a choice, a bad one, and now they paid their debt to society, and now we're trying to give them that second chance. But I made an incorrect assumption of what I thought the problem was. Mm-hmm. I rendered judgment and categorized these traumatic sufferers as they. You know, if they were more responsible, if they just had made better choices, if they just worked harder as I had, then they would not be in this position. And so as a result of both my complicity, my ignorance, I actually contributed to the problem, because when we're complicit with perpetrators and broken systems, if we refuse to see what's really happening around us and enter in, then by definition, we're adding to the problem.
To the problem, right.
And there are people all over this world that are suffering from trauma. So Susan and I actually had to stop looking at these assessments after the fourth class. It was too painful. But therein lies the problem, I think. We don't want to look. at horrors occurring all around us. And so we choose not to know, or we try to block it out until it infringes on our world, on our own comfort, on our own relationships. I believe that the evil, sin, suffering that do not touch our worlds, we work extremely hard at keeping it at a distance.
Right.
And now, after these 2.5 years of running Concordance, I've worked with many, many people in the normal course of events would never have been brought into my life. And maybe, perhaps, the thing that's affected me most is just listening to people that have no words. It's like wordless grief. Because these things were not a part of my life. They belong to other people.
Mm-hmm.
But they were brought to me, and I was invited in, and going into such things is naturally disturbing. It affects our thinking. It affects our feelings. It's affected my sleep. And so I had to change my mind about things I was sure were true,
mm-hmm.
and ask questions that I thought had already been answered. And my love of comfort, my tidy life, and just the nature of things in this world meant that my heart had to be transformed by God. Because I love these things too much in my natural state. And God commands us to do justice, love mercy, and walk in humility with those that are oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
But I want all of your listeners just to imagine for a moment that whatever horrific event that occurred in your own life or your listener's life or maybe through your child's life, just imagine going through that alone. All the fear, all the depression, all the anxiety, all alone. And I would ask, how do you think you would have survived? You know, where would you be right now? Because that is the experience of all of our participants. You know, it's just been very eye-opening for me, and it's changed a lot of my view, but it didn't come from me. I started doing this because it was a head thing, it was a problem to be solved, and it quickly became a heart thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for sharing
that. May be
your story.
A little much, but I just wanted to cover a lot of
things. Isn't it good? This has been such a pleasure. I just so enjoyed talking to you. I could just sit here all day and just listen, and
you're
just doing some awesome work. I'm so glad that you had eyes to see and to open your eyes to what's going on. But I want to talk, before we close out today, I really want to talk about the Something Extra. This is Something Extra podcast. Talk to me a little bit about what you believe the Something Extra is that every leader needs. And it can be a couple of Something Extras if you want to.
It's hard.
Not just a, but a couple maybe.
Humility would be one that comes to mind. And I like the definition that C.S. Lewis uses around humility, which is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking about yourself less. Because, again, I think we're prone to make a lot of stuff about us. And if you don't have true humility and you don't understand that your sole purpose on being created on this planet is to love God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and to love your neighbor as yourself, then I don't really believe you can be this servant leader. The primary job of a leader is helping other individuals in the organization become the best that they can. And, you know, that requires a great deal of not only humility, but it requires honesty. But a lot of these things won't happen until people truly believe, not through your words. We talk around here a lot. We don't really listen to people's words that much. We watch their feet, because it's natural that I may want you to judge me on my good intentions, but you can only judge me on my actions. And so when we talk about watching feet and helping people the best they can become, this internalization that my job is to first and foremost understand you. I mean, understand you not as a professional, but as a person.
As a human being.
And so every interview I've done for 30 years, the first interview I do is I ask them to start from birth and stop at high school and just tell me everything about them, because I want to get to know them as an individual, not as a professional. We can cover that later. Because when you take the time to truly understand somebody, it implicitly validates the self-worth of somebody else. And I believe the deepest hunger of the human heart is to be understood first. And when you understand somebody and what they're dealing with, everybody's got their own story, then I think you can truly help that person. But there's one thing that, you know, I was taught, I've tried to do this all my life, is we strive to be the very best there is, not the best we can become. And if you have that mindset, it does lead you to a different place in terms of how you manage your team, how you make clear specifically in writing what the expectations are, how you evaluate people constantly, how you give feedback, praise, but also pointing out to people.
Being honest and
being honest with people. You know, we have an expression around here, we like to catch people doing good, not just catching people doing bad.
Right.
But the whole point here is, being the very best, not the best you can be, you will manage your team differently because you have a standard. And to be fair to the organization, you need to make sure that everybody is operating at that particular standard, and you'll run your organization quite differently. And I think it actually has this self-correcting effect. People typically will opt out if they don't fit the culture. If your culture is strong enough, then
they'll
people won't feel
themselves
comfortable being there.
Exactly.
But humility would be one, because we're naturally inclined to think about ourselves. And I've actually tried to give people a little test, like see how long during the day can you go without thinking about yourself. It's hard. And I think that's one of the issues that you have even when we talk about trauma. I mean, when people are hurting, it's very hard not to be thinking about yourself. And so I've always felt in one's life, sometimes you're going to be in a place where you truly can help others, you know, you're healthy, you can provide a lot of value. The reason I believe I was blessed is to bless others. But there are also times when people are hurting, and it's okay to acknowledge that place in your life. And when that's happening, we ought to be hugging and spending as much time helping those individuals that really it's difficult, you know, for them. So everything I think about in terms of career, personal life, or whatever is how may I best serve my king. Like Paul talks a lot about, you know, he uses the word bond servant, which is so powerful because it gets at the heart of the fact that we have been purchased by the Lord, and a lot of distractions happen throughout the day. And so by just staying focused on relieving me from the bondage of self and asking God, you know, how may I do your will, not my will. If I don't do that,
it's a daily thing.
It's a hard thing.
It is a hard thing. It sure is.
Thank you for letting me diverge a little bit. I don't want to come across as holier than thou. I mean, I'm probably the most sinful person in the room. So,
I just know where my source comes
from.
Sure, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you. Loved
our time together.
Thank you.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2018. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit lisagailnichols.com/somethingextra. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen.